The fear here is that, you know, us, you know, we're young, we're stupid, we've made mistakes, and how do we recognize whether we're being arrogant about it or if we've actually, you know, stamped out the evil from within?
I don't know, like, at times you realize that it's something wrong that you've done, but we tend to think that if I admit my mistake right now, it's going to pull my image down, it's going to make me look bad and weak. You know, it's pretty simple, yet it's difficult. That we just need to know that, you know, strength and weakness or respect and glamour isn't defined by these things. You know, if I'm admitting to my mistakes, it really means that I'm strong enough, I'm brave enough to, you know, negate myself, something that I've already done. And if I think I'm going to be humiliated, all I need to know is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants me to admit my mistakes, right? If it's before Him, that's another thing. If I've wronged another person, it's another thing. In both scenarios, He does want me to admit that I've done wrong. Fair enough that He doesn't want me to be in a place in the first place to be to be admitting it. Why? Meaning that I shouldn't do that's whatever that's wrong. But once I've done that, if I think that it's humiliating to admit, then I'm mistaken. Why? Because Allah says, "Walillahi al-izzatu jami'a," right? Or respect, or what do you? How do you?
Honor.
Yeah, it's all His, right? So if you think you're going to be dishonored when you admit to your mistake, it's quite the opposite, because you're obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala when He says, "Admit to your mistakes." And when you do obey Him...
Yeah, I think you're really onto something here, because it really is about arrogance, because the arrogance is worse than the sin itself.
Yeah, that's
a hadith. There's a hadith that says that the sinner is worse than the sin, and the doer of good deeds is better than the good deed itself. But if we explore this theme further, we'll find that the Ahlul Bayt teach us that the sin that a person commits, which makes him feel humiliated and humbled, is better in the eyes of Allah than the good deed which makes somebody feel like they're really good.
Or arrogant, in other words.
And it makes them arrogant. So I think we've really engaged one of the most important factors here, which is that sense of arrogance. That is really what Allah is trying to train the human being to avoid. How do you do it? It's impossible.
Why is it impossible?
To constantly feel not arrogant.
Even if, like, besides the point of arrogance, even if there's no arrogance or arrogance involved, heading towards the Hadith Qudsi that says that do not look at the little wrong that you've done, walakin انظر إلى من عصيت. Look at whom you've disobeyed, right? Do not look at the tiny, as you said, about the small wrong act that the doer thinks is small is...
The biggest sin is the one that we consider to be light.
So he comes back to the Hadith Qudsi. It says that do not look at the smallness of or the littleness of your sin, but look at whom you've disobeyed.
Think about it. That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the show. From myself and from Brother Mahdi, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call Creator, my Alpha and Omega, my Protector and my Maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my Defender and my Savior, my Giver and my Taker. Abiding in silence with patience.
The month of Tir on the Iranian calendar marks a series of tragic events that occurred during the early years of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. From the U.S. Army's shooting down of an Iranian airliner in 1988 to the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group are examples of the incidents that fall in the same time frame, between late June and early July.
The U.S. footprints can be traced in almost all of the incidents that occurred during this period. The events were so harsh and fateful that are still remembered by Iranians after decades. Every year, Iran marks June the 26th to July the 2nd as the week of American human rights. As a jab, that questions the U.S. standing as rights advocate.
The week-long occasion is associated with nationwide ceremonies. Each day commemorates one of the incidents. The first day marks the attempted assassination of the then-president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981. The second day marks the bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran in the same year. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti. The event is known in Iran as the 7th of Tir disaster. This incident was also carried out by the MKO terror group. In 2012, the United States removed the MKO from the list of terrorist organizations, something which is interpreted as Washington's dual take on terrorism.
The United States' hostility toward Iran became more evident after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. It supported Iraq's Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran, and also funded and supported the MKO terrorists in numerous attacks on Iranian people. So we reviewed these incidents during this week to let the world know that the U.S. is not a defender of human rights.
The week also marks Iraq's 1987 chemical attack on the city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province during the eighth-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. At least 110 people were killed and 5,000 more were injured in the attack, which was carried out using chemical weapons provided by the U.S. and some other Western countries.
The chemical bombardment of Sardasht was one of the most heinous crimes against humanity. Sardasht was the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki to become the target of weapons of mass destruction. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed a huge arsenal of chemical weapons, which were produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Observers say Washington portrays itself as the defender of human rights across the globe, but it uses the issue as an excuse to exert pressure on other countries, while closing its eyes on its own rights violations. Organizers hope the week-long ceremonies will help shine a light on the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin has been sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of African-American George Floyd during an arrest in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. This came after a jury found 45-year-old Chauvin guilty on April 20th of unintentional second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. President Joe Biden reacted to the court's decision, saying the prison sentence seemed to be appropriate. But civil rights activists, as well as members of Floyd's family, had a different point of view.
This sentencing is the longest sentence we've seen, but it is not justice, because George Floyd is in a grave tonight, even though Chauvin will be in jail.
When you think about George being murdered in cold blood with a knee on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, execution style in broad daylight, 22 and a half years is not enough.
This right here is this 22-year sentence they gave this man. It's a slap on the wrist. We serving a life sentence of not having them in our life, and that hurts me to death.
We didn't get what we wanted. We definitely wanted to see the maximum penalty, but however, as they've already stated, we do have the federal ahead of us.
Experts say Chauvin's trial was a stunt to distract African Americans from their main demands.
I think what we're seeing here is more bait and switch and distraction. When they focus, and the media is complicit in this, the U.S. corporate media, because what they do when they focus on trials like this, they're trying to distract what the ultimate goal and the primary goal of the movements, the uprisings are.
The video of the white officer kneeling on the neck of the unarmed black man in handcuffs for more than 9 minutes sparked outrage in the U.S. and around the world. However, Floyd was just one of thousands of black victims murdered by U.S. police. According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. A disproportionate number of victims were African Americans. The group says black Americans are 2.5 times as likely to be killed by police as white people. Meanwhile, inspired by the verdict in George Floyd's case, relatives of other police brutality victims in the U.S. have also come forward demanding their cases reopened. But as many see the recent court ruling against the murderer of Floyd far from proportional to the crime he has committed, justice in the U.S. society seems to remain as elusive as ever.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all have a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Said Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Said Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Said Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Berry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Said Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Said Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he asserts that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability, and political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Said Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Luxurious Avonfield apartments located at Park Lane, Mayfair in London. The family of thrice-elected former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has been staying here for decades. A trial court sentenced Nawaz Sharif for 10 years in 2018 for owning these flats, which the judge found were purchased through money laundering and ill-gotten money. Sharif left Pakistan in late 2019 after being released, allegedly on the basis of false medical reports, to once again reside in this palatial residence. To the shock of the former prime minister, back in Pakistan, now a high court set aside his appeal and upheld the verdict of the trial court. Sharif was declared a fugitive of law by the court when he backtracked his commitment with the high court to return home within a few weeks after the medical treatment. This has now led High Court to reject his appeal for failing to return home despite his earlier pledge with the court.
I think Nawaz Sharif should not have fled the country, and now that he has been declared as fugitive or an absconder, that's not good for him. That will actually soil his political reputation. For now, you know, Nawaz Sharif is in trouble, and politically, I think his position has become more precarious.
The High Court verdict has come as a major political victory for ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan, who came into power in 2018 with the pledge to prosecute Nawaz Sharif and other opposition leaders on corruption charges.
ये यकीनी तौर के ऊपर पाकिस्तान के आवाम की फतह है.
This verdict is a victory for the people of Pakistan, and this verdict is the victory to the ruling party's anti-corruption campaign. We believe Nawaz Sharif must return the money he looted from the people of Pakistan.
The former prime minister still has one chance to appeal with the Supreme Court of Pakistan to set aside his conviction. But for that to happen, Sharif must return home. Otherwise, legal experts believe that the top court may also reject his appeal. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Shocking footage filmed on the 18th of June, Iran's election day, shows Iranian expats being attacked outside polling stations up and down the UK. Victims included women and the elderly, the perpetrators, supporters of anti-Iran terrorist groups, including the MEK, communists, and Shah royalists.
Videos released on social media show fanatic protesters hurling Islamophobic abuse and even physically assaulting voters in cities including Birmingham, Manchester, and here in London too.
One victim reached out to tell us about her ordeal.
As soon as I got near the embassy, I was wearing the hijab, obviously, and the crowd started roaring and screaming. They got louder as they saw me, obviously, going to vote. Calling me names, calling my family names, cursing my mother, my father. I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously he couldn't understand Farsi. He was telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now. I was so shaking. Yeah. Since then, I've suffered with anxiety since that day. I said to myself, I should have left. But I stood my ground. I said, why should I leave? And the people coming, I said, why are you calling me names? They said, we call you names because you deserve it.
Britain boasts about being a defender of democracy on the world stage. But these violent scenes suggest that the UK failed miserably to protect democratic rights of Iranians inside its own borders. Despite these attempts, Iran's election went ahead with President-elect Sayed Ibrahim Raisi coming out on top. Robert Carter, London.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with a lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, everyone, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected, whether it's, you know, the infection has caused or the mental health, or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy. So I'm stuck in England for quite a long time. And I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mom for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days, and red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amber-list countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions, with protections that come from the vaccine, with respect to international travel as well. But it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement, but with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Puriza, London.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Kerr Now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people who are recognised as a Celtic minority have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it.
were a long colonised race, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
Got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking, and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashrai, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S., even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Masked Zionist troops will still terrorize Palestinian children in the middle of the night, but new military jargon will hide the true purpose, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article titled, Israeli regime's night raids on Palestinian families aren't over. Please stay tuned for the first part of the article. The videos are all over YouTube. Masked Israeli regime troops storm a Palestinian family's home in the middle of the night. Parents dressed in nightwear are suddenly surrounded by heavily armed men. Young children are forced awake with a mix of blurry-eyed confusion and fear. They are made to answer questions posed to them in broken Arabic by these faceless armed strangers. They are lined up in one room while the Zionists take photographs of them holding their identity cards. And then, just as suddenly as they arrived, the masked men disappear into the night. There are no questions beyond identifying the people in the house. No one is arrested. There is no obvious purpose, just the family's sense of security permanently wrecked. To most people watching these startling videos, such scenes look like an Orwellian nightmare. And sure enough, Israeli regime has given this procedure an Orwellian name, intel mapping. Last week, under pressure from the courts, the Israeli regime army announced that it had ended the practice of mapping, unless, and this will be a loophole easily exploited, there are exceptional circumstances. Given that the families whose homes, privacy, and dignity are invaded are not suspected of any offense, it is difficult to imagine what exceptional circumstances could ever justify these degrading and terrifying raids. In announcing its decision, the Israeli regime army said that in the digital age, there were other tools it could use to gain intelligence on Palestinians, beyond randomly invading their homes with guns in the middle of the night. A statement added that it was a humanitarian gesture aimed at mitigating the disruption of citizens' everyday life. Palestinians are subjects without rights living under a belligerent military occupation. And this is not about disruption. Palestinians aren't facing an unexpected train delay, but a form of collective punishment, and therefore a war crime. As a report by three Israeli human rights organizations published last November observed, it is highly doubtful that any instance of mapping could be considered legal under international law. Nonetheless, these home invasions are commonplace. They are integral to the Israeli regime's army policy of surveilling, controlling, and persecuting Palestinians. According to figures compiled by the United Nations, the Israeli regime army carried out around 6,400 search or arrest operations in 2017 and 2018 alone, with each operation potentially including more than one home. Research by Yesh Din, an Israeli human rights group, shows that the vast majority of such operations start between midnight and 5 a.m. In a quarter of cases, Israeli regime troops break down the door to enter. And in a third of cases, a family member is physically assaulted. Two-thirds of families have experienced these invasions more than once. Intel mapping operations have been particularly difficult for the army to justify on any kind of security grounds. That led earlier this year to unwelcome scrutiny from the Israeli regime's top court, which gave the army until August to divulge the wording of its mapping protocol. The army's cancellation of the practice means the rationale for traumatizing thousands of Palestinian families over many years will continue to be a secret. The reality is that mapping was never really about building up a more accurate picture of Palestinian society. It has many other far more sinister aims. In practical terms, it is used to train young Israeli regime troops, familiarizing them with the techniques of invading Palestinian homes and intimidating Palestinians, all in a safe environment for the troops. The army knows that Palestinian parents will be primarily concerned with protecting their children from the terrifying presence of armed intruders in what should be the family's safest space. In testimony to Breaking the Silence, an organization for whistleblowing Israeli regime troops, one troop observed, "There is rarely an operational motivation for it. Often the motivation is practice, meaning we got a breaching tool for forcing open doors for the first time. No one knows how to use it, so it is decided that we break into a house now." But there are other, even darker purposes behind these random mapping raids. They are part of the gradual process by which the army acculturates its young troops into a life of committing habitual war crimes. It breaks down their sense of morality and any remnants of compassion after years of exposure in the Israeli regime's school system to anti-Palestinian racism. It turns Palestinians into nothing more than objects of suspicion and fear for the troops. Or, as one Palestinian woman told Yeshdin, "The way they banged and came into the house was like entering somewhere with animals, not people." Terrorizing Palestinians, even children, quickly becomes part of the humdrum routine of military duties. But most important of all, home invasions traumatize Palestinians in ways designed to entrench the occupation and make it more permanent. They are a form of psychological warfare, a campaign of terror against both the families and the communities they live in. They reinforce the message that the Israeli regime army is everywhere, controlling the smallest details of Palestinians' lives. Several troops told Breaking the Silence that the goal was to make Palestinians feel persecuted. One noted, "The bigger mission was to instill a sense of persecution in the Palestinian population." That's not my phrase. It's a phrase that actually appeared in military presentations and briefings. The troops take this guidance to heart. One said he understood the purpose of hiding his face was to be more intimidating, scarier, and then maybe you get less resistance. Mapping raids are designed to make Palestinians believe that any kind of opposition to the occupation is futile or counterproductive. Home invasions leave permanent scars, as women often describe feeling violated and losing a sense of pride in their home, while men suffer from the trauma associated with being unable to protect their wives and children. Children are left with anxiety and sleep disorders, and they struggle at school. There is a further goal to these mapping operations when Zionist settlements have been built close to the Palestinian families being targeted. Home invasions take place on a regular basis for these families, serving as a form of pressure to engage them to abandon their homes so the settlers can replace them. A 2019 UN survey of an area of Al-Khalil coveted by settlers found that, over a three-year period, 75% of Palestinian homes in the neighborhood had been mapped. One resident, whose home was raided more than 20 times, told Yeshdin researchers, "I think the entry by soldiers is just harassment to drive us out of the house."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, and I'm Atal, the host of this program. We have two guest speakers in today's discussion, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Nahwi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother. And Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me here.
So regarding the main features of the hegemonic powers in today's world and the challenges that they are facing, for today's discussion we want to get a very important topic which was also tackled by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of Iran, and that is the challenges that the hegemonic powers have regarding the Islamic values in today's world. The thing is that when you look at some of the Muslim lands, you find them as a caricature. You know, for example, in terms of their food, they still use the same food as their forefathers did. But in terms of observing their hijab, they're very much similar to the Western world, in terms of their makeup too. So, and the sad news is that sometimes the value system which is in the West, and it was abrogated, it was forbidden, so many laws and constitutions were written against them, are applied in the Muslim lands.
That's true.
For example, if a foreigner or if a people in the US in a bar has going to one mini glass of wine, no, you can find it in the bars of some of the, unfortunately, Muslim lands, you know, a bottle of wine is going. Bottle by bottle. Or for example, if under 18 cannot watch this and that movie and the rating is over there, now it's this rating is going to be. I do want to say the value system has inserted into the culture. This is the sad news. And another sad news is that sometimes we forget completely that we can replace this value system with the good things that we have. But we take them for granted.
You know,
taking all of them for granted.
Yeah. You know, the main issue is we forgot something.
Yeah.
Which is very important. That in this world, there is an evil and there is a good.
Mm-hmm.
God has set a path for us.
Yes.
And that which deviates us from that path is evil.
That's right.
It's not the discussion of West and the Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a discussion between like West and East, Muslim and non-Muslim. It's not about this.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about, are you being the true servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, mm-hmm, or the God or not?
That's right.
If you're following the evil, evil never wants you to have dignity, to have independence. It wants to make you the slave, either in the sense of, you know, being under the slavery of capital system.
That's right.
Capitalism.
That's right.
Or the secular system.
Okay.
So all these things are being, you know, brought by evil. And evil is doing its job the best way it can.
Recently I saw some comments and some posts on the Instagram regarding LGBT, you know, lesbian homosexualism. I said, wow, come on. You know, this movement is banned in some of the Western countries.
Yes. You know, every single religion has banned it. Every single.
Yeah.
Christianity, Judaism, I don't know, Hinduism, everyone.
Yeah.
Within this religious script, it is banned.
Yes.
But obviously, you know, the evil is doing its job.
Yes.
We forgot that the evil is our enemy, but evil never forgets.
That's all right.
Okay. So it's true that you said that there is no conflict between West and East, or let's say Islam and non-Islam.
No. Sayyid said that when you want to look at this value system, look at it as an evil good thing,
yeah.
Not the Western Islam.
I do agree with that.
Okay.
I just wanted to actually explain for those who are listening to us. But since it has the representatives of each has been seen, for example, in the West and the other side in the East, so it comes to the mind that, okay, this is a conflict between East and West. But the root is there.
Mm-hmm.
The root is really what you said. But since those who are actually defending any of these two opposing ideas,
yes,
are in this part and the other part,
yes,
of the world, so it says that, for example, that whatever. No, we do not mean that whoever is in the West,
that's
is bad,
right,
or whoever is in the East,
you
is
know,
good.
I purposely do that. I said, like, we forgot about this. Why? Because in the East, even we have evils.
Very true.
You know, the Muslim countries, the leaders, they're silent on the issue of the Palestine, for example.
Yes.
They're silent on the issue of Afghanistan.
For
the reasons they have.
True.
Yes.
In the West, there are many people who raise their voice,
mm-hmm,
against the, you know, the oppression,
okay,
that has been done by Zionist regime,
that's
or Israel,
right,
on the Gaza,
right,
Strip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have seen, for example, in London, 150,000 people came to the streets.
Very,
yes,
true.
In the solidarity of the Quds, or the Palestinian people.
But what about the Muslim lands?
Yeah. So, so we need,
yeah,
to,
really,
we need,
it's,
to,
it's a
we need
question
to remind
to
ourselves.
Have you
yes
ever seen such a thing, for example,
we
in a country like Saudi Arabia? Or,
no,
for example, in a country like
UAE, or Qatar,
but
or
unfortunately,
Bahrain.
They are going for normalization of their relationship.
We need
with
to remember,
yeah,
that this evil and the good, we have forgot this.
They normalize.
And you know, when we say West and Muslims, within Muslim lands, they think like, okay, we are Muslim, we are the right people, so nothing is wrong with us.
Uh-huh.
That's why they're not raising their voice.
Mm-hmm.
You need to differentiate. We need to remind ourselves that there was, from the first day when Adam alayhi salam was created, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has ordered like the angels to do sajda to Adam, there was a discussion of an enemy of the Adam, and that was shaitan, the evil. And it was the promise of shaitan that I will, for example, like hijack all these you know, the values of the descendants of Adam alayhi salam.
Yes.
We need to remember this, because you know, when we go back to the origin of everything,
mm-hmm,
the things are very easy to explain.
Yes.
Yes.
But when we do not refer to the origin,
mm-hmm,
then obviously we can find many examples. You know, these are the examples. We say masadiq.
That's right.
We generally talk about the individuals,
yes,
examples, not the origin. So we need to refer to the origin, inshallah.
That's all right. But
yeah,
steadfastness of the Muslims are really important. You know, this muqawama and this resistance, you know, is very important. But unfortunately, we could see that. Again, when we get back down to this Saudi Arabia, you know, Ben Salman thing, the case is that the discourse is changed.
Mm.
You know, when Trump was in the power, so all of a sudden when Trump goes and another government in the U.S. comes, their discourse also changes,
mm-hmm,
towards Iran, maybe towards the other lands. And this shows that how much puppets they are,
mm,
to the politics and the policies of the U.S. and the superpowers.
Well, maybe
in
it's
the
because
world,
like Trump has milked all milk.
Mm-hmm. No, they have much milk, brother. There is still to milk them.
It's nothing
so
much
milk and milk. The black milk is oil. Yeah.
As I think the outcome of all this discussion is, and Sayyid referred to also, and I at the beginning of my discussion said, so the root all goes towards the good understanding of Islam, what,
mm,
we call it pure Muhammadan Islam. And they are all the subcategories of,
yes,
this discussion.
Yes.
So if they are the arrogant powers, or let's say hegemonic powers, they are against it, they don't want us to go back to this understanding of Islam.
That's all right.
The outcome of which is unity, anti-arrogance, and let's say anti-Israel, and let's say intellectualism and rationalism.
That's
Islam
right
world.
I don't know, in Afghanistan, for example, they are progressing the peace talks. You know, the peace talks are over there, the representatives are over there, the superpowers are over there. At the same time, we could see bomb explosion over there, this barbarism over there, you know.
Do you know what is the reason of this new bombing in Afghanistan and Iraq?
No.
This is the new strategy, brother. Look, when the other guy, when the other one left the White House, the next one wants to warn the countries that they said that we don't want even we don't want U.S. to be there anymore. Mm-hmm. They want to say these are the outcomes.
Yeah.
These are the reasons that we need to be there, mm-hmm. and then. There is another thing, brother. This is for me, you, and other, all those who are listening to us. Whenever Israel, look, there is a key equation in the region. Whenever Israel is in danger, other nations should be in danger as well. Whenever there is a, let's say, conflict between Muqawma, resistance line, and Israel, other countries should be in instability. So these are the two reasons of these new and recent bombardings in Afghanistan or Iraq. And we have to be waiting for.
Yes, we can just add in, like, whenever the Israel is in danger, obviously, why they do bombings in other countries is so that the people in those countries, the Muslim lands, mm-hmm. basically, it's not happening in non-Muslim lands.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening in Muslim lands. Why it happens? So that these Muslim people do not raise their voice. So they cannot come
to
help.
The awareness level.
Yes, and they stop them by bombing the Muslim lands so that the people from these lands do not come to help the Gaza Strips or the Palestinians. So there are many reasons, obviously, and these are clear. Those who have a little bit of intellect, inshallah, everyone possess the intellect, they can understand.
Yeah.
All these things. If I can just give you an example of how, you know, the West creates, you know, wrong kind of, you know,
attitudes
or, you know, the wrong thinkings, like how it ejects into the minds. For example, you know, in West, there is a talk about the equality, the female and male equality. Mm. And they said that the women do not have their right.
Mm.
It's all about male. The world is, you know, male prominent. That's how they say.
Yes, they say.
It's a male prominent.
Yes.
Mm.
But they never look at, like, in the wars, there were the men who are killed. You know, on the streets, it's the men who are the most victims. You know, in the jobless or homeless people, it's more men. So, you know, there are different ways.
But
of
the same voice that says such thing, they are totally silent when women and when women and
children
and infants in Israel are being killed.
Yes,
day by day, and no
in
one
Palestine,
is saying anything. So aren't they women? Don't they have the rights?
Unfortunately, you know, this male orientation towards running the country, much male. I mean, not looking for the just attitude, as in Islam says, leading to such movement like feminism. An extremist feminism, okay, that brings us up, okay, why the women should be pregnant, men can be pregnant too. See? They are talking.
This is not in his capacity.
This is not in his capacity. But I do want to say, no, we could see such slogans nowadays, brother.
Right, if they want male to become pregnant,
can female
do something that the male
I don't know.
This is Islam when, again, invites us towards rationalism. And
we have
this
to.
This Islamic intellectualism.
Getting back to origin, what Sayyid said. Getting back to the origin, and poor earth, how much capacity this earth has,
all these things
to behold all these phenomena, all these disasters from day one until now, and it's still working for us, man. It's still running, still rotating, still having energy, having rain for us. You know, everything, resources, tabia is over there. How much poor earth is, brother, tolerating all these phenomena in today's world? And I think that one day we have to do our right of just and justice to ourselves, toward the earth we are living.
You know,
You
pointed a very good point. For example, you know, if chickens stop giving eggs, you know, what's going to happen?
If the cows
if they protest, like the cock should obviously give the eggs and we should rest.
Yes.
You know, there is a nature. There is a nature.
Brother.
You cannot change it. The world is doing its job.
Yeah.
The trees are giving fruits.
Yes.
The water is there. It's because of us humans that we have the shortage of water.
And how much
the environmental
justice,
change.
Yeah.
And we are doing injustice towards this nature as well.
Yes.
We are oppressing this nature because of our you know, inventions and the things that we have. So
nature,
we
animal, you know, if there was going to be a big rally and demonstration of justice, be sure that it would be first the tabia, the trees and the sheep and the animals.
Yeah.
And we have to answer that, brother, in the other words. Okay. That's all right. Nice discussion, nice fruitful discussion regarding what are the Islamic exact values of the Islamic system, how to revive them, and why the Western and hegemonic powers are opposing and confronting this value system. I hope that all the Muslim lands get back to the pure Muhammadan Islam, practice the pure Islamic values, and we get back to our pure original nature and fitrah. Innate nature, inshallah, one day. It was very kind of you, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Brother Ali Alavian. Nice, fruitful discussion. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Viewpoints, a discussion on the views and lectures of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you, dear listeners. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. This series are produced by Brother Mahmoud. Please bring your comments and ideas. We can say on our email address, coi@irib.ir. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Do not forget, too, to visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian, Call of Islam page. See another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
So far from you, yet to me you were always so close. I wandered lost in the dark. I closed my eyes to all the signs you put in my way. I walked every day further and further away from you. Ooh, Allah, you brought me home. I thank every breath I take.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.